competitive spikes who are also teachers. So it comes across with like a very informed and educational component that is built around winning. And we use that as a metric and we try to stay as far away from it as we can.
Gonna reveal my companion, gonna pay three, gonna grab my new legacy delight. My MO's always been ticking vile up to three. Why go over when all you get is the monarchy? When you try the vile a little less consistently, and we know they're gonna prismatic ending it anyway. Playing 80 cards, but it's alright. Grinding Moto Leagues till the early light. All these challenge wins make my spark ignite, and casting solitude is getting so exciting. Sky Noodle in flight.
Legacy delight. Legacy delight.
Hello and welcome to the Canadian Threshold, the Legacy podcast that's activating Mangara and holding priority while you slowly stare down at our Caracas. My name is Quinn O'Murray, and I'm here as always with my giggling co-host, Jeff Kinsey. Jeff,
you did have a good one.
I had to think of something for you three. And Brendan McBain. McBain, how's it going?
I'm jealous because I have never gotten to do that.
What?
I know. I've only admired it from afar, but it's a beautiful interaction.
Let's not get too much into Mangara yet, because we also, I feel like the summer of incredible guests. We're still going strong with another incredible guest, Mr. John Ryan Hamilton, probably better known in Magic circles as XJ Cloud. JR, how's it going, man?
Hey, happy to be here. I actually have Mangard and Hell Parody earlier today, so.
Ooh.
There you go.
Sir, you came prepared.
We have JR to talk about all things D&T. Before we get into that, a little detour. Jeff, you want to do some housekeeping?
Yes. We're down to the same thing as always, which is Puget Sound Battleground 3 happening October 2nd and 3rd in Everett. There's still tickets available. As of right now, I think we're mostly hoping that the Canadian border gets opened by the time this happens, because it was recently pushed back to September 15th, I think. So we need to dodge a bit more. Things are getting in a kind of hairy position, and this will be very upsetting after getting excited about this for, I guess you count all of the moves like over a year and a half. It'll be very upsetting if it happens and we can't go.
We're getting into turns and we're running out of top decks.
Yeah, exactly. So if you don't have a ticket and you're in the area, even if you live in Canada and you're skeptical of the border, pick up a ticket. I'm sure it'll be fine.
So JR, just a bit of background. Puget Sound Battleground 3 is kind of like this new nascent tournament that's being run out of the Seattle area. And it's a two-day event, all Eternal Magic. So it's got Canadian Highlander, old school, modern Legacy, a couple other things. It's got Team Trio events. Artists are there. It's kind of like a mini Eternal weekend on the West Coast. And it's something that I've attended the first two, and this third one was kind of like right on schedule from a yearly cadence. And then good old SARS-CoV-19 SARS-CoV-2, there we go, showed up and kind of deferred everything. So we've been really looking forward to this tournament for over a year now. And things were looking a lot better, I have to say, in the summertime. And now as we're entering the tail end of the summer and the fall, it's becoming more and more skeptical. But
I'm in a similar boat. St. Louis has our single tournament, giant tournament hoster, Jeremy Aronson, who hosts massive tournaments all the time. And he had two different ones. There was a 40K and a 100K that were scheduled that were both delayed by COVID, and now the 100K is lined up for late October this year, and things have been getting worse than they were months ago. It's not looking great, but Jeremy's a great guy, and obviously playing it very safe. He's been very cognizant of that, those issues. But I'd not heard about this Seattle event. Maybe one day post-pandemic I might fly out.
Yeah, nice if thing. You ever...
Oh, go ahead, McBain.
If you ever want to attend the nicest LGS there is in existence, Mox Boarding House in Seattle would be the place to go. From the likes of like PVDR, like world-class pros, they will say this is the best place down in Seattle. It is the Shangri-La of LGSs, and it's definitely nice to attend. It is not where this event's being held. This is an arena. But the Mox Boarding House runs a fairly regular legacy tournament series. And it was kind of going from like a monthly with some bigger quarterly 5Ks humming along, but obviously this is all going to get reorganized and changed, but there's a very robust community in Seattle and the Vancouver area. So definitely attend if you're ever able to.
Yeah. What I was going to say about both the Puget Sound Battleground and Jeremy's events is that, you know, they're both being run by very smart people. So, you know, I trust them to do whatever they need to do for the events to get them running properly. You know, unlike some of the ones you see on Twitter these days where, you know, two people have a mask and everybody else is like shaking hands and swapping decks and like open mouth kissing on the table. It's...
These filthy Delver players. Jeez.
That's how you decide who goes first now. So gotta make the rules.
So I think I had one other public service announcement for housekeeping. And that's just if you do attend an event, this podcast endorses you wearing a mask while indoors, washing your hands, and following all like the best practices, regardless of what your jurisdiction chooses to ignore. Definitely be wearing a mask and washing your hands and things like that. And go get vaccinated if you haven't already. God damn it.
I guess as a piece of this whole thing, I was thinking about this earlier this week. So yesterday was my first wedding anniversary. Great, very celebratory, very nice. But the other thing it was the anniversary of was I was away last year when we recorded the podcast on the time my wedding was happening. So McBain and Quinn here recorded Jeff Tech, where they went over me and all the things that I am, mostly the things I'm bad at. And a lot of it was talking about D&T. And it feels very fitting as also a gift to myself to come back to that a year later and talk with somebody who has the skills and can speak to all the good things that maybe I don't quite get right. So very happy to have JR on here to talk about D&T from a winning perspective.
I'll do my best, but no promises.
I think you both are selling yourself a little short here.
I think part of being a Death and Taxes player is you need to learn a certain sense of humility and accept losses gracefully.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't play Death and Taxes if you feel bad when your opponent casts turn one Dark Ritual of Doomsday or whatever. It's just like, yeah, I signed up for this.
I was gonna say, as like a brainstorming filthy combo player, I think you have to have a little bit of like self-deprecation to look at brainstorm and be like, no, not for me. Excuse me. I play in hard mode.
I can't handle that many decisions. I get to like look at a bunch of different cards every turn. Nah, just I can look at the cards in my hand, and sometimes I can look at the top card every turn when I take my draw step, and just I don't need to make more decisions than that.
In all seriousness though, like I find, not to get too far into this, but I pick up hands of like starting hands of D&T and I'm like, I don't know what to do. Like, you can't fix this hand. I can't, do I keep this? And I'll look at Jeff and be like, this is not keepable, right? And he's like, oh yeah, that's great. I'm like, because I'm used to being like, but I'll pick up a hand that's like four lands, two or fetches, and there's like a brainstorm and a ponder. I'm like, oh, this is great. And so that just, to me is way easier.
I've really been enjoying, Jer, the kind of just little screen clips that you've been putting up on Twitter to say like, hey, would you keep this hand? Like, this is the situation. And generally they're not like ones where it's like an easy kind of call, like yes, no. It's like seven layer responses deep of like why this is correct or not correct and what you're playing around. And it really, one, shows your experience with the deck, but it also helps really bad D&T players, because there's a lot of those, get better. And I think that's a huge service that you're doing for the Legacy community. And I don't know why it is, like, maybe you could speak to it a little bit about why you do that in terms of helping, kind of like putting yourself out there and helping educate everyone. But I think it's great. So keep it up.
Yeah, I've been having a lot of fun, like kind of recently. I don't always do that, but I've been like playing a little bit more Magic than usual. So sometimes I'll see an opening hand that's just like, I think this is reasonable, but it like looks really weird. Like the first one I posted was like four planes, two Field of Ruins, and a Sanctum Prelate versus lands. And it's just like, all right, yeah, six lands, one creature. This is obvious mulligan, right? And then I had like a breakdown of why I thought the hand was really good. And there are a couple after that, but
because Prelate on two is obscene and I don't like it as the lands player.
It's gotten worse. There's blast zones in the mix now.
Yeah.
And you just lose like Valakut Exploration, just doing
it. Yeah, Valakut Exploration exists.
Oh man, the brief moment where there's Prelate on two and there's nothing, no blast zone, nothing, and you're just like, well, this is it.
Back when it was like Barbarian Ring as the only out, and you're just like, yes.
I did not enjoy those times. I was definitely like main decking one Barbarian Ring for those situations.
Yeah, it was so great. Like those the one time I felt like my lands matchup was really good, because like pre-conspiracy, like pre-recruiter prelate, the lands matchup was just really bad for Death and Taxes for so long. It was just like, all right, lose game one, and then you like rest in peace and surgical and pray game two. But then prelate came out and the dynamic flipped, and then lands got like five new cards, and then the dynamic flipped back. But
I love those games against lands, because you're like, I need a prelate and I need a way to keep it alive. And it's like, I have to engineer these like situations where, you know, you do something to force them to do something first so you can sneak the prelate in like after. I mean, you still get that now with like blast zone, but it's like, I have to pressure them enough for them to pop this so I can get this in now. I'm like, yeah, those are great.
Yeah, that's the scrappy kind of Death and Taxes playing you like. So just to kind of start things off, JR, you did a podcast before this, which was the Dark Depths podcast.
Yeah.
Shout out and to them. Great. Yeah. Shout out to them. They do. I hadn't really heard of their cast before, said everyone about our cast. And I went and gave it a few listens and I really like it. Sometimes they talk about Modern a little too much and I have to like wonder where the timestamps are so that I can skip past the Modern piece. We won't be talking about Modern today. And you covered a lot of great material there. And if people are really interested in exactly the kind of tools around the Yorion matchup or the Yorion deck and how it's kind of working in the current metagame, I would definitely encourage people to go listen to that first or after this, but definitely go there. You did a great job. I think that was your first podcast that you did?
The first time I was on a podcast.
Experience? Like, it just felt like work and like a video call or?
Yeah, it just felt like chatting. I the one thing I really love about Magic is talking about like the things that I enjoy, and probably my favorite deck in the world, obviously, is Death and Taxes. So like I will like talk people's ears off about the deck. Have a whole group chat that initially started because it was like four Death and Taxes players that I knew and we wanted to like talk about it and stuff. And it's just like evolved into like a friend group of a bunch of different people. But just, I just love talking about Magic and talking about Death and Taxes.
It sounds like you're on the verge of starting your own Death and Taxes podcast, to be honest.
I would. I could probably fill in a lot of episodes about random Death and Taxes stuff. The deck has a lot of depth.
Yeah.
That would be a great joke for the Dark Depths podcast. No.
Boo. Derailed.
C minus at best.
Jeez.
So one of the spots I want that we usually start on with a guest is kind of their coming up story, or like how they started into Legacy. And you covered this a little bit on the Dark Depths podcast, but it was kind of the typical D&T story of, I wanted to play Legacy and it was cheap and affordable, and therefore I was a D&T player. But like, what really drew you into the deck? Were there like any particular showings at an event or people that were playing it that just made, like, was it a people thing, or was it just like how the mechanics worked and how it interacted?
So one thing about the types of decks that I like, it's a very weird range, because on one hand, I like these like weird, terrible creature decks. That's just like, you look at a deck list and it's just like, how does this ever win? You're casting Flicker Wisp, people are playing Grizzlebrand, whatever. But on the other hand, I also like just like complete nonsense combo decks, which I don't really explore a lot in Legacy. But like in Standard, the best example was like the Jeskai Ascendancy combo, or like Eggs in Modern. The common denominator is really just like, when you look at a deck list and you don't know what's going on at all, it's just, I don't know what it is about that, but it, I really like it. So for Death and Taxes, it was like, it was looking at cards like Flicker Wisp and just being like, why is this in your deck in the format where people are casting Tendrils of Agony or like 2-mana 8/8s and whatever.
But yeah, my buddy played Foil Rug Delver and he wanted me to get into Legacy. I'm like, well, I'm a high school student. I'll see what I can do about that. And then I built Death and Taxes. I almost built Elves, actually. But Gaia's Cradles were too rich for my blood.
That also follows the same kind of like, I think you have a more kind of straight path as to like, you know, looking at the deck, what it does. But that's also like, you know, just all the stuff going off, you know, yeah, finding your intricate spots. You know, Rug Delver versus D&T, that's a good time to get in and practice that. Is that like proper like Rug Delver, like Nimble Mongoose?
Yeah, it was like Threshold Mongoose.
Yeah.
Oh. Rogue Stifles.
That was have you ever
matchup.
Have you ever like rebuilt the decks from back in 2013 or 2014 and just played for an entire evening? Because
I've not played against a mongoose in a long time.
It is our mascot for this
yes,
podcast.
Canadian Threshold Podcast.
Yeah. the goose is very close to our heart. The D&T like original Canadian Thresh matchup is so fun. It's really intricate. The games can be so long and so grindy, as with many of those like old Canadian Threshold matchups, mm-hmm, where they think they're like, oh, you're just going to Delver, Daze, Wasteland, win the game. And you're like, no. It's going to take the whole 50 minutes here to win this, actually. What was the year like, and what was going on when you initially kind of built your D&T deck?
It was around 2013 when I really got into Magic, or into Legacy specifically. I started Magic at Gate Crash, so I think that was like early 2013 or something. And I got into Legacy a little bit after that, like right before I went off to college. So I built Death and Taxes, and then Trinity Nemesis came out, and that was really fun. Got my ass kicked by Jeskai Delver a bunch of times. I just kept playing the deck. At some point, I don't know when it was exactly, it switched from just being like, I'm never going to buy dual lands, to like, I actually just really enjoy like the play patterns and like everything this deck has to offer. And I can't like point to a single instance, but I guess one of the big motivating factors, I think, for a lot of fledgling Death and Taxes players at the time was Thomas Envoltson, who's like the greatest D&T player of all time. The classic video of him beating two Emrakul attacks, I think it was the one that I always think about. He like blocked one with an Aven Mind Sensor or something. He like sacked 12 permanents total.
Was this 2012, if I'm recalling right?
I forget the year that
it was one of the GPs, and he like studied so hard for it.
Yeah.
And knew every matchup perfectly, and did exactly his plan. And now I'm going to have to go watch that one game after this.
Yeah, same.
I remember watching a clip where, you know, he's like porting somebody with like miracles on upkeep or something. And, you know, they like go to like reveal Terminus and like the draw step. And he's like, oh, like in response to like the miracle, like, you know, Violent Thalia. And they're like, just all of a sudden like, oh, like I'm stuck. I can't do anything. Like, yeah, a lot of that stuff was definitely, you know, piquing all of my interest in playing the deck.
I think that was Bara versus...
was that not Invuldson?
Yolset? I think on SCG is the Violent Thalia versus Terminus, I think.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many good clips. So the spirit of like get them.
the two people that initially came to my mind, actually there was three people. There's Craig Wesco, there's Thomas Anna-Voltzen, and Mark Koenig or Bara. And like those are like the kind of triumvirate in my mind of D&T godfathers.
Yeah, definitely.
But I think the two Emrakul attacks is probably the top of the pile.
Yeah, two Emrakul attacks is iconic.
Yeah, but like Craig Wesco as well, just like always being kind of just shitty white deck player in like all formats is a pretty amazing brand. Like you've got, you know, like, I don't know, like the sugary Cocoa Puff cereal, and he's just like the most amazing full English breakfast of white weenie brand that you could have. Okay, I was just curious, like, how far back you went? Because like, I don't know, when I've played for a very long time, like Urza's Block is when I really started playing competitively. And when you've played for so long and someone says, oh, I started in Gatecrash, I have like zero reference of like where and when that was. But like saying like, oh, True Name came out, and I'm like, oh, okay, I know a little bit more. But
right at the start of the Death Rite era, before people realized that card was super broken.
It's amazing some of the cards that just kind of go under the radar for a while.
Yeah, I mean, and Deathrite was printed like 2021. It probably would have been broken in like a week, but I don't know. It was just a different time back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh man, Thomas Anna-Voltzen, so good. Now I'm just kind of like distracted and thinking of that.
Watch this clip after this.
Yeah. Oh, it's pretty incredible. It is. It is. Truly spectacular magic. I want to just kind of touch on one of the comments that you made on the Dark Depths podcast. Again, shout out, go listen to that. This is a question. So why are D&T players so bad? And this was a clear statement that you made, and I think I can get behind it.
The war for like, yes.
What are some of the things that like make them so bad, and like, do you have any advice or kind of things that they could do better, other than like obviously solve your Twitter hand puzzles that you've been doing?
So it's tough. I don't try very hard not to dunk on D&T players too badly, because a lot of them, I do think the deck very obviously attracts a lot of budget players. The deck's easily like one of the cheapest options if you want to play Legacy. I think that's like a big reason why we see a lot of more inexperienced players like trying the deck. And I think the deck is also very punishing for people that don't know what they're doing. So it's kind of a negative spiral of like, oh, worse players will pick up the deck. And also like the deck's a lot harder to get into than a lot of decks. And a lot of people will just kind of like spiral and not understand what to do. Like I get a lot of comments about people that don't want to play Yorion, not because they don't think it's good. Some people don't think it's good and they're wrong. But some people just don't want to like buy two more recruiters and like four solitudes and a Caracas. And it's just like, yeah, I mean, I totally understand. I sympathize with that. Like play what you can afford to. And I don't want to push people to spend another like $400 to build super optimal D&T, whatever. But I think the biggest thing in terms of leveling up for me were understanding how other decks worked, because D&T is a deck that is constantly playing reactively and just wants you need to understand what your opponent's game plan is. You need to be able to like pick up on what your opponent's doing when they like go Misty Rainforest, fetch island, cast the cantrip, and you're just like need to zero in on like what deck they are rather than just kind of just zone out and like, oh, I cast my Stone Fortress and my Thalia, now I'm dying to show and tell or whatever. A big thing is like just being able to understand your opponent's game plan to craft your own. And then also, this is kind of a boring point that everyone repeats, but it's also just very accurate, is just like watch or read about good players piling the deck. Like we were just talking about, I watched a bunch of like Enivoltson videos, Bara videos. The best way to learn a deck is to watch people that are way, way better than you. And then like you see their lines in real time or maybe in old video time, whatever, but you get to see a hand and be like, what would I do here? And then you see what they do. And then you kind of question why they maybe took a different line than you. And I think that's a good way to try to level yourself up as a D&T player and get me to stop making fun of you.
It does seem really unfair that like the deck that's kind of objectively the easiest to get into in terms of like money also needs you to kind of be aware the most of the format.
Yeah.
It's definitely funny in that sense. Cause I think you get a lot of people to just pick it up and like, okay, this is just like, you know, I play Mom, I play Stoneforge, I get something big. And then I crunch in with my, I guess now with Kaldra or something. And like, that's the deck, you know, and I have disruptive pieces to support this. Yeah. Rock on McBane. But yeah, it really is categorizing it as like a control deck, you know, and not even just reactive too. It's like a proactive reactive. Like you have to like, you know, was it in chess? And like you set your next move up. So it's like ready to go.
I'm not a chess guy.
Is there a term for that?
I don't know. Preloading your move, you know, you just know it's you have to form what you're pretty sure is going to happen.
But yeah, that is that's a perfect analogy, actually.
It reminds me of when I was drunkenly playing against Dylan with Canadian Threshold against Miracles down at one of the old GPs. And it was like late at night, and I would like put one of my cards down, like as if it was like a trap card. Like a Yu-Gi-Oh! Trap card, and Dylan would take his turn and he'd do his move and I would just reveal it. And I'd be like, I do this. And I just kept doing that. And he's like, what the hell? How are you so good at it? I'm just like, you're very readable. I know what you're going to do. And I'm just going to put my card down and react to you. So two comments that I had on that. I've had D&T for a while. I've always been really scared of it myself because the mirror match just terrifies me, and I have to play against potentially Jeff, who like is really good at D&T and will just crush me because there's no free wins with D&T really.
Yeah.
Like other than like really obscure stuff where you're just like, oh, Thalia against like the Storm deck that just had a bad hand or something like that. Like there's not really too many free wins and you have to work for everything. And for someone who, again, kind of is learning the deck, not only do you have to know the whole metagame and what decks are doing, but you have to like actually like assemble your game plan and execute it, which is really challenging. In the Vancouver area, I've tracked the metagame and like every deck that shows up every week for years, not so much in COVID, but like before that. And D&T was always the most popular deck by a long shot. And it always performed really well as well, because we have several good D&T pilots. But I think of Nathan Lippitz, who's actually pretty popular in the Legacy community now. Like he was once a little fledgling Modern player.
Nate's a local.
Yeah, he's local, and we converted him from Modern a long time ago into Legacy. I actually sold him a whole bunch of cards to kind of like get him into D&T and Mono Red. And now he's on Omni and a bunch of other stuff, but he's gone from wanting to put bad 4-mana casting cost cards in random Modern decks and playing in Legacy to like quite competitive, performing well and doing a really good job. So, but he had actually kind of got into D&T as his first deck and then had to put it down to be like, this doesn't work. But now that he's really good at the format, he can pick it up and be like, oh, I get this. I understand what I'm doing and I can perform well. just one final point. You had recently done a Twitch stream with Dugs on Twitch.
Yes.
And as for someone who was getting back into Yuri on Death and Taxes myself, I went and watched that and it was actually really good. Aside from like one random game where like he punted like three or four times in a row in one spot, which was pretty hilarious to watch. It was like when a train derailment happens and like the rest of the cars don't stop moving. But other than that, it was really great. And you did a very good job at explaining like why you would do one option or another. So again, we can link that in the show notes, but that is a great kind of starter video for people.
Yeah. I used to stream a lot more, but, just kind of fell to the wayside of other things, but I've gotten a couple of Yuri on DMT streams off. I streamed the Anurag 1.2K that I won. So there's like 8 or 9 rounds of that for content. I also, we conned Anurag into playing the winner's list. He signed off on it in like round 2. So then I went and won the whole thing. And so we conned him into playing DMT and I came on for that. And so I went on to one of Anurag's streams and played D&T. I don't know if Anurag's VODs are available. I think he put some of the matches on YouTube, though.
That I want to see. I haven't seen that, but that sounds hilarious.
I don't think he put my favorite match, though, in the video where we played against Blue Green Omni, and I got to slowly try to explain how to Peacekeeper lock someone.
Quinn.
Had a 256 fractal token from some stupid green enchantment from whatever that Strixhaven.
Yeah, Strixhaven Commander decks.
Yeah, exactly. Paradox Zone?
Yes, that's okay. The one. Yeah.
And I had to walk him through the Caracas plus Vialon 5 plus Yorion plus Peacekeeper kill.
That's amazing. I believe there's a Peacekeeper in like Espervile, where you know you mostly do it the hard way, where you're like, yeah, I'm just going to pay 2. But being able to just flicker it off your turn is sick.
Yeah, you got to do what you got to do sometimes, which is hit them with a 4/5 flyer for 5 turns and hidebind a Peacekeeper and a Sanctum Prelate.
One of the things from playing like Yorga on D&T is just like how often just like. I mean, 5/8 mana, 4/5 flyer is just like good enough. Like you're just kind of in these games where, you know, you're drawn out and nothing's really happening and everybody's just like running off cards. Just like, all right, like time for the bird serpent to come in and you just play it, attack, get that in for a few turns.
Yeah, I guess also speaking towards like D&T content that I put out or Yorion specific, I wrote an article back in late 2020 about your D&T back in like the Oko era, when I thought the deck was really good as well. And like one of the things that I pointed to was just like, Yorion's really good in just all your fair matches, even when you don't think it's going to be very good. Like, oh, Delvers. Okay. I'm never going to be able to pay 8 mana total to ever get this thing into play. But a lot of the fights against Delver is you throwing all of your resources at not dying. And then your opponent throwing all the resources at trying to kill you. And then you both sit there with like, 1 card in hand sometimes on like turn 8 or 9 or whatever, and then now you have a 4/5 flyer and they don't.
Yeah, if you're going 1-for-1 with someone, having an extra card is pretty big.
Yeah, exactly.
Was that one that was on Min-Max, right?
Yes. I've written 2 articles for Min-Max, but one was not really Yorion related. It was just new cards. I've been meaning to write a new article for Yorion for I guess there are a lot of upcoming tournaments, I guess. Seattle, St. Louis. Eternal Weekend Online's supposedly happening eventually.
There's been the one mention, yeah.
Don't have
you got it. You've got to repeat your success from last year where you had written the guide and like the kind of how to play D&T. And then I remember looking at the stats where you had like Delver, Snow, and then D&T like came out of nowhere and just all the heroes in the world kind of like spirit bombed and played D&T and performed really well. That was great.
That was one of my favorite
line players. D&T on one hand, and you know the JR Bible in the other. It's like, okay, following the flow charts.
Yeah, I made like a bunch of like matchup guides and stuff. That was one of my favorite moments as like a content creator. Was I wanted to make something for everyone that was coming in to like Magic Online just to play in like Eternal Weekend Online or whatever. So I put this thing out and I put this like stock deck list. I was like, this is probably where you want to start. Maybe make some tweaks, whatever. And then like, I think of the like 11 published D&T lists or something, like 9 or 10 of them were on basically the list that I put out. Like one of them won one of the Eternal Weekend events. And like, I didn't do very well in any of them. I think the best I did was like X and 3, the first one or something. And I just got like whomped in the other ones. But it just felt really cool to like be able to put out a piece of content and have it like very visibly impact people and just have a bunch of people like have that much success.
I think that's right. It's fantastic. Like the legacy community in particular, people who like other than what we call eCloud and just getting, you know, the sick brags, just out of the goodness out of your heart, like the labor of love of like, I love this deck and I think you would do well with this information, here you go, is something that really keeps me part of the legacy community and not wandering off into some other trying to be competitive format. Like the people who really do it for the community and also do it for their decks community as well is just fantastic. And I salute you, sir. Is there any like particular D&T resources that you'd want to shout out beyond all the articles of yours we're going to have to link in the show notes of this?
Not a lot of D&T content is being produced lately, unfortunately. Phil Gallagher used to put out a lot of stuff, but he's kind of moved on to greener pastures.
Like as in, pun intended, green pastures?
No, as in just like, he plays a bunch of like weird off the wall decks, makes a lot of like YouTube content with like weird quirky decks, more than like being a deck specialist at this point. I think the best place at this point is probably just like the legacy D&T Discord. I'm a mod there. They're usually helpful when you want to ask questions. There are a bunch of resources. There's like a whole like section in the Discord for like old articles and stuff. There's like Thomas Edmondson's old guide to like death and taxes and stuff like that. But yeah, not a lot of actual content being produced at this stage.
Yeah, I think that one of the shout outs from the Dark Depths podcast, and I know Jeff and I had kind of shouted this up before, but I think it was Isolated System did a Reddit post about the 60 card version, which I found really interesting. Like in a way you have to play the deck quite a little bit, quite differently. Like I think they had like 3 cataclysms in the sideboard, a bunch of stuff where your sideboard's doing a lot more heavy lifting in the 60 card version, as opposed to like our combo ham sandwich that we have in the Yorion version, which I quite like because I always get a little concerned about sideboarding properly, but it's really easy when it's like, are they on combo or not? Okay, then.
That's what I always tell people. Just like some people will come and ask me, like, how do you sideboard the deck? I was just like, have you looked at the sideboard? It's extremely easy. you read all your cards and then you board in none of them against a fair deck. And then you, against a combo deck, you read all your cards and then you just shuffle them all in and just cut cards at random. And then you're fine.
We're going to move on to start playing like 90 card decks.
Got to fit in all the extra bullets. On a 110 card Yorion D&T.
Do you remember, this isn't really anything, but was it like 2, maybe 3 years ago, somebody kept playing in the challenges just an increasing size? I think they're playing elves, but it was like, you know, 60 cards, and then it was like, oh, it's like 67 cards, and then it was like 73 cards. And like there's no incentive for doing this, but it was just every week it just kept going up. We should try this.
I don't remember that at all. I do remember, I think it was Solnox who used to play like 110 card Yorion green shit pile. Just like absolutely no reason to have 30 extra cards in the deck, but you're just firing off of the memes.
That's some good memes. Question, as someone who knows next to nothing about D&T, at least from like the playing side, my, like the way I think about it, unless I'm playing a deck that like folds to Thalia, is like the most important card and the thing that I hate the most is Aetherphile. And you have four of them. And then you add 20 more cards to your deck and lower your chances of getting an Aetherphile. You don't have Brainstorm, like us cheaters. What makes the 80 card version worth playing, even though you're like lowering, like you have no card select or very little card selection, and you're like lowering your chance of drawing Aetherphile in your first opening hand?
Yeah, this is the classic question that I get all the time of like why Yorion is I've been calling them vile truthers. People that will just blindly be like, but I want to draw my vial on turn one. And it's like, yes, sure, you do. But you're like, Aether Vial is like so much more of a dicey proposition in terms of sticking in current era Legacy now more than ever. Now more even than like the Oko era, I think. I guess the four color piles were on like Okos and Abrupt Decays. But now it's just like, Prismatic Ending is the big bane of Aether Vial's existence. That card is very good and very popular for a good reason. But it just means you can't keep like loose Aether Vial hands just ever. Just you used to be able to get away with one land Aether Vial hands a lot as long as you're on the play. And like, so you're not getting dazed or like thought seized or whatever. But now I will mulligan almost all of my one land Aether Vial hands unless like you're in a very specific matchup with like very key other five cards in your hand. So yeah, the big thing is that just Aether Vial isn't as good as it once was, and you need to be able to play a competent game of Magic by just casting your spells with your lands. So you just like, yeah, Aether Vial is still a good card, obviously. We're going to be playing four of it. It's one of the best cards in the deck still, but you really like don't want to be leaning on it more than you want to have like just the extra consistent power of having a Yorion in your hand every game. And as for like the rest of the deck, basically all of it is extremely interchangeable with the extra 20 cards that you get to put in. If you look at a 60 card D&T deck, a lot of it, especially after in the post Skyclave era, 60 card D&T players are just like running out of space for stuff. We'll be on like two Skyclave, three Flicker Wisp, two Spirit of the Labyrinth, like two Recruiter, one Prelate or whatever. If you just like look at a 60 card list and then you write four of in front of all the cards instead of like three of or two of or whatever, and you just build a Yorion list. Just like four Recruiter, four Wisp, four Skyclave, four Spirit, whatever. So it's like there's not a steep drop off. And it's something it's the main talking point that I try to point people towards is like the big thing about adding 20 cards to your deck is that you're decreasing the average power level, right? Because the 20 cards that you're adding are going to be worse than the first 60 cards. Otherwise you would have been playing them already. But like D&T's power level curve is already very flat. Like Thalia and Spirit of the Labyrinth are fairly interchangeable in terms of the effect that they can have on a game in terms of taxing cantrips and stopping combo decks from like going off. You're going up on like now that the Solitude exists, you don't have to play like Path to Exile is really mopey extra plow. You just have like eight plows in your deck. You have the same like flicker effects, Flicker Wisp, Charming Prince, stuff like that. So the extra 20 cards, just you can afford to do it because they're mostly doing the exact same thing that the rest of your deck was doing.
Solitude is such a nice addition for it too, because there's so much overlap on like the cost of putting those extra cards in your deck when, you know, you just get to have a bunch more plows effectively that are better than Path to Exile is so nice. And then obviously the rare times you actually get to like, say, evoke it and then like Flicker Wisp it or like hit it with the Yorion after casting it and flash it in and like combat and like, you know, get rid of something, like the actual value outside of pitching it for a swords is very good. And also just always having another white card you could have in hand for three mana is very strong.
Yeah, Solitude is like secretly, or maybe not so secretly, one of the best cards in the deck, I think. Solitude, like you were saying, it just has so much synergy with the rest of the deck in every single aspect. Just like you can evoke it in and then Violent Flicker Wisp. You can pick up Yorion, then cast your three mana plow. If you hard cast it, you have all these like flicker effects to just reuse the ability, or it's just like a plow with a body that you can put equipment on and stuff like that. Just very similar to Skyclave Apparition in terms of like, it's a very powerful effect, but it's also a very powerful effect that D&T specifically can just utilize every single piece of.
Mm-hmm. Also, like, being a creature spell, like, the amount of times I've played against, like, Omni Show or something somewhat recently, and, you know, they have, like, an Emrakul they get to put in, and it's like, well, you know, yeah, this isn't a colored spell, so, like, all right, yeah, exile your Emrakul. And being able to, like, do it through things like Deafening Silence or something, like, it's been very good.
Oh, like, as someone something. who likes creature combo decks, like, the old thing with D&T would be, like, sure, play Thalia and you have one planes, like, good to go. Or put, what's the guy who stops spells?
Really?
Prelate. Prelate on one is, like, when I'm playing Infect, I'm like, yes, Prelate on one. Put Prelate on one. And now, Prelate on one just shuts off my swords when I board them in.
As a lands player, I always loved Rashad importing, like, one of the two lands when they have Thalia up, and you're like, swords offline, and then you get to do your thing. There's two thoughts that I had. I don't know if it's, like, a positive or negative to the 80-card list, but for the one-ofs in the deck, like, it almost becomes, like, a 0.7 of in the deck. Like, it's even less than a 60-card deck, obviously, because you're diluting your one-of even more. And that flat power curve of, well, I only want this for certain matchups and I have recruiters to go get it. And I really would just rather not draw it in, like, any old game of Magic. Your one-ofs are even better in the 80-card list because of that, which is, like, something I haven't heard a lot of talking about. Unless you just, like, nut draw your Peacekeeper like I did last week for two of my matchups, which was fantastic. And I forgot how much I love Peacekeeper. Quinn's shaking because he was one of the people who succumbed to a Peacekeeper. But so there's, like, that dilution of your one-ups, which is, I think, a pretty interesting thing and doesn't really come up in a lot of situations. Yeah, like, have you explored that at all? Like, the whole one of dilution thing at all?
I've messed around with it in terms of, like, playing a handful of bullets. But one thing I've fallen back towards is I think people kind of get too in the weeds about, like, playing the cute one ofs sometimes. And I think D&T gets away with just, like, kind of quad lasering out most of the deck still. Like, the only one ofs I'm playing right now are, like, I think a prelate's obviously is always going to be at least one of, but, like, not something you're, like, playing four of. And then, like, there will be cards that have, like, similar effects. Like, you can play Charming Prince as, like, kind of a wisp. I was playing Walking Ballista, I think, in the Anurag event. That's kind of a unique ability, but something that was, like, powerful enough that I kind of liked access to it. But in, like, the older versions, I was playing, like, a one of Remorseful Cleric and, like, a main deck Anthrosworn Canonist and was, like, considering main decking a Containment Priest, except for Modo's bug, so I wasn't able to do that. So, yeah.
The secret end boss, Modo.
Yeah, I guess a pro tip for people playing Death and Taxes on Modo is that, so the way Yorion and Containment Priest are supposed to work is that you flicker out your whole board, including the Containment Priest, and then all your stuff comes back, just like when you show and tell and a Containment Priest doesn't exile their Emrakul, because it comes in at the same time. But on Modo, and it's still bugged as of, like, I tried it, like, maybe a month ago or something, a couple of weeks, it will just bring your creatures back in a random order, and as soon as it hits the Containment Priest, everything else just gets exiled. So don't imagine that your whole board.
I would love that to be, like, a line in the big, like, the big tournament of, like, okay, we're gonna roll the dice and hope that our Containment Priest comes out last, and then we're gonna get there. So the other thing that I've kind of noticed about the 80 card version, and I think it was most popularized by Reed Duke, but it's the idea of, like, lineup theory. And that's just, like, your cards lining up against your opponents. And with the Yorion version, you have so many one for one effects. Like, you got your Skyclaves and your Swords and your Solitudes. And if you're just making your land drops, delaying the game, like, you're just sitting there and you're like, I'm going to one for one that. I'm going to one for that. And you're like, I have twice as many removal spells as you have win conditions. Try me. Like, I don't even need this eighth card. Like, I'm just going to keep killing your stuff. And I have more cards than you. I think that's, like, the secret hidden mode of the whole deck is that you just can outlast anyone.
That's why you have the 20 extra cards, so you can just draw go longer.
Well, that's you and your chess clock on MTGO. But. Yeah,
unlucky that you can't deck Bant players anymore because they have endurance, but I used to genuinely just deck Bant players sometimes.
Yeah, I loved reading that outline in like Isolated Systems thing, talking about playing against Bant. It's just like, don't even think about like winning the game. Like, you know, you're just here to stop them from killing you, and the rest is just going to happen.
And that was even the 60 card version. Like, yep. It was interesting, the Saga deck as well. I can't remember what deck guide I was reading talking about the Saga deck, but they're like, oh, yeah. It might have been TNT, but they're just like, oh, yeah, just deck them. Like, they can't do anything. Just beat all their threats, and they'll just deck, and you can crack their standstills because they'll die faster, which I found particularly interesting. So this kind of goes into a comment. I don't know if you made it, but someone else has made it, and it was the best card printed for D&T recently has been Ragavan. How much do you agree with that? And like, could you talk a little bit more about it?
Yeah, I made a similar comment. As someone on Twitter, someone did well with D&T and then they said like ban Ragavan or something. And I said, but if they ban Ragavan, then people will start playing cards that are good against death and taxes again. Because I do agree with that statement to a certain extent, except for specifically me. Ragavan is great against me and bad against every other Death and Taxes player. Because whenever you hit me with a Ragavan, it'll flip my board for 100% chance. If you go watch the Otterog, the 1.2K I keep talking about, the hit rate on Ragavan hitting Mother of Runes on turn two was insane. That's like the only good hit in your deck, though. Like, so there's a kind of pitfall that people fall into, just like, if you don't play good cards in your deck, then Ragavan doesn't have good hits. Obviously, that's not a good line, right? You don't like make your deck worse to play around Ragavan. But the thing is that some decks in Legacy are very synergistic rather than just playing powerful cards. And most of those decks are the non-blue decks, like Elves and Goblins and D&T and stuff like that, where like, sure, you can hit an Aether, I guess Aether Vial is actually maybe okay for them. I don't know, like a Stoneforge Mystic or even a Skyclave Apparition is hard to cast, or like a Goblin Matron or anything out of Elves, basically. And just like the hit rate on Ragavan, the reason Ragavan is so good is not only does it make a Lotus Petal for a turn, which is obviously very powerful, but it also like draws half a card. I don't know the exact math, but against all these cantrip decks, they're so fine tuned, like Low to the Ground has like 31 drops in it, whatever. You're so often you'll hit a Ponder or a Lightning Bolt or a Brainstorm or a two mana Murktide Regent or whatever, and that these the Ragavan decks are like really cannibalizing each other, and the cards are not good against non-blue decks, as people have like started very quickly finding out. Especially against D&T specifically, it's so great. People get baited every single time. They will cast like your bad cards. A, Thalia Spirit are symmetrical. They never want to cast those. People do it anyway for some reason. But like, I've had people cast my Spirit of the Labyrinth and then try to ponder and just like, nope, this is not Hull Reacher.
Right, they cast Spirit and you're like, thank you. Like,
yeah, this one can stick around. But also you play four Flicker Wisps and like sometimes the Charming Prince and also Skyclave Apparition. Skyclave Apparition says the exile card's owner makes an illusion. So if you exile your own card, which you can't do unless your opponent controls it, you get an illusion after your Skyclave dies. And then Flicker
Wisps. Well, I didn't even think about that one. I knew the Flicker and the Charming Prince. Like, that's like classic Aether Vial technology with the Gilded Drake shenanigans. But Skyclave, that's savage. Imagine them like saving up all their little Lotus Petals, like, you know, I'm going to go to college, I'm going to get a degree, I'm going to cast my three drop that I stole yeah. from you, and they like get their Flicker Wisp, and then you just get it back from you.
You have a 2-2 with a 3-3 inside when it dies.
The Skyclave thing rules, because I love moments playing Magic Online that just cause somebody to stop, you know? Like, you know, that's like, okay, yeah, I'll blow your Skyclave, and then you get the token, and it's like, you know, just see a clock ticking down for like 20 seconds.
Literally in the challenge this past weekend, I was playing as Blue Red Delver and they stole like my Stoneforge Mystic or something. And then I Skyclaved my own Stoneforge. And then they like bolted the Skyclave to attack with Ragavan again. And then I got a 2-2 illusion and they typed in chat, I did not know that's how that worked.
That's great.
So I wanted to move to some of the new cards that have come out, but I want to go on like I think an obligatory tangent, and this is really to help Quinn get into this conversation. And I think we should all just take a few minutes and just talk about Oko and the time that was Oko, the 500 days of Oko. The three of us, mainly Jeff and Quinn, spent those 500 days really complaining, complaining about Oko. And I know you hated Oko as well, Jared.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about your, like, I know like the, you and Jason kind of were the originators of this 80 card deck that came of from the Oko era. So like we have one positive thing to think about it, but like, could you talk a little bit more about the Oko era from your perspective?
Oko era was horrible. I wanted to quit Magic so many times, but as so many Magic players know, you don't quit Magic. You just like take a small break and you come back. But yeah, like right around when COVID started, I stopped playing Magic nearly as consistently. I played like a lot of like aggressive bullshit, like Chalice decks. I played Turbo Muxus when that happened in like the summer of 2020 ish and just like slapped people with like turn three, like hard cast Muxus or whatever. Oko is the least fun Magic card I've ever played against in my entire life, I think. And it's not particularly close. The card is just so egregious. And a lot of blue players specifically are complaining about Ragavan because, you know, Ragavan's really good against blue decks. And I would like them to think about all the times that they were casting Oko against Death and Taxes and then think about all the times where they're getting Ragavan and know that they deserve it.
I want to say that I'm a filthy blue player, but I've cast neither of those cards and I refuse to.
We can ban Ragavan in 6 months, whatever, I don't care. I don't think it's actually very bannable, but like if the blue players complain loud enough, sure, whatever. As long as they've suffered, that's all I want.
I want my pound of flesh. I do enjoy, I'm trying to think of the last time I really felt a card was doing what Ragavan was doing, but that idea of like the blue decks, it's like the US and Russia in a Cold War where it's just like mutually assured destruction. Oko is attacking them, but everyone else is, I mean, Ragavan is attacking them, but everyone else is just like, what's the problem? Like this card's fine. I just trade with my Brother of Ruins or I'll trade with my land or else. Like, I don't see what the big deal is here. But these like
creatures forehead,
these like blue superpower decks though, that think that they should just like rule the world. And then all of a sudden this monkey just starts stabbing them for two and taking all their cards off the top of their deck that then they get to cast for value. I do think there's a certain like romance to that. And I like that. I like that effect. So one of the things that you did write about in one of your articles, at least this year, was card evaluation. And particularly when Modern Horizons 2 came out, which is kind of like what I like to think of as like 3 to 4 years of Magic cards all released as one set.
Yeah, pretty much.
At least when it comes to Legacy. And I think everyone was holding their breath, terrified of Modern Horizons 2 coming out.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you're in exactly that position as well, especially when we got to the other side of Oko era. I think things are a lot better than they could have been.
Absolutely.
But I'm curious, like, if you could just talk a little bit about how you evaluate cards when it comes to just like, for lack of a better term, shitty white cards and or cards that go with shitty white cards.
So to start, there is a meme that is pinned to the D&T Discord that is, I think it shows up on Twitter a lot too, but it's like the anime guy with the butterfly. Is this a pigeon or whatever the original name is? I forget, but it's they're looking at whatever the new, any card with a white mana symbol in it at all. And just like, is this D&T playable? Because D&T players love more than anything in the world is extremely niche hate bears that are just really bad. And it happens. People get baited every single time. Every time Tithe Taker gets spoiled or the 1/3 from Ixalan that stops people from casting things not in hand, whatever that guy's name is.
Draenith Magistrate?
Yeah, that's the one. Draenith Magistrate. Sure, yeah. People will just immediately be like, is this D&T playable? Guys? And then the answer is just always no. They're never D&T playable. I've been tagged a lot in white Magic card spoilers on Twitter, and exactly once has someone said, is this D&T playable? And it was in fact D&T playable, and it was when Skyclave Apparition got spoiled.
What about what were some near misses in your mind? Or it's just like, you know, it was close. You gave it a good shot, but not quite there.
Sanctifier Invec, I think, was really close. I've been on hand and knee wanting Rest in Peace on a Grizzly Bear for a long time. Rest in Peace is not playable in like any deck in Legacy at this stage. People use their own graveyards. It's fine. We can make a better Rest in Peace, guys. I promise. But obviously, Modern Horizons very targeted at Modern, and Sanctifier Invec very powerful in Modern, where pro-black, pro-red, and the graveyard exile effect is very relevant. But that card was like kind of close for me. But the graveyard misses, in addition to the protections not being super relevant, like the fact that it doesn't exile Uro is a big one, but like Life from the Loam, a lot of other like graveyard synergy stuff, doesn't exile enough from Delver to be like super relevant against Murktide Regent, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the protections not being super good, people are like, oh, it's a pro red card against Delver. That's good, right? They can't kill it. The thing is that like they just don't care. They don't want to kill it.
Right, they have like a flying 8/8 at this point.
They have a bunch of flying creatures, and you have a 2/2 with Pro Red, and it doesn't matter. You're not going to erase them. So that card, I think, was close. I really want Rest in Peace Bear at some point, but the fact that Sanctifier Invec exists means that I will probably never get my wish. But other cards that came out, I was actually just super wrong about Khaldra. I thought that card was super win more. It was just like the stupid, it's like a 7-mana equipment from Innistrad that like flips into a 13/13.
Elbrus?
Oh, the Elbrus, the Binding Blade with the Gnar. It was just like, oh yeah, it's a pipe dream. You're just, you never untap, like I get Batterskull Stranded in enough hands. You're never going to be able to cast Khaldra. And then I played like one game with Khaldra in my deck and I was like, wow, this card's incredible. I was wrong. I'm sorry, Khaldra. I'm sorry.
There's so many games you end up in and you're just like, if I didn't have this card in my deck, there's no chance I'm winning this game.
Oh, absolutely.
But like you just have to put the foot down and you're like, yeah, I'm just going to smack you for 5 with this consistently.
So I've been picking up again since this Yorion craze started again. I was Jeff and I were both the people who were like, what do you mean I have to buy a fourth Caracas? Like it felt like a violation. I don't even think Jeff bought one. I think Quinn just lent him.
Oh, I'm just looking at them. See if I see the right one.
But so we did it. We jumped into the deep end. But I have been like over the moon impressed with that card. Like the Khaldra Complete is just like when it's win more, it's actually just win. Yeah. Like there's games where like you're like, oh, my main plan is I just play this card. I turn off my brain and I just start hitting in with it and like they just have to deal with it. It's very impressive. I finally
wired my brain to understand every single line of text on that card. Most recently, most people. McBain played Stoneforge and I was like, I get like Khaldra or like Jit and I'll just blow the Jit up and then I don't know, Khaldra, I'll just like blow the Khaldra up and then I'm like, yeah, sure. And he gets Khaldra and like puts him to play. And I'm like, I guess I'll Force of Vigor. And you're like, no, you can't do that. It's indestructible. I'm like, no, just the thing's indestructible, right? No, it's indestructible. It also exiles. You can't block. It has first strike.
Yeah. When I played last webcam weekly, I had to remind, like, I was Quinn, both things are indestructible, like the germ and the artifact. And then my other opponent was on Alluren and they had 2 veteran explorers in play. And I was like, attack in. And before they even went to blocks. And I was like, I recommend you do not block this card because those things are getting exiled and you're not getting any of your fancy lands. It was very rude, but that card is so impressive. And it really filled that gap that terrified me of D&T. which was like those really long stalematey games of like, how am I even going to win this ever? The ones that Jeff just loved because it was just like eight dimensional chess of it was, what were you saying? The Yorion Peacekeeper, Aether Vial, Caracas on five. Like it was that every single game. And that just terrified me. Like I like the interactive games of D&T. I don't like those ones as much. And I especially don't like those ones game after game. But the Caldera is just, it gives you at least one card to have that just says, you know, deal with this and we're just going to bash it. And they can bounce it or something and you're eventually going to replay it. Yeah, it's fantastic. And then just like little things like flicker wisping it to get the germ back on it and stuff like that is fantastic. So yeah, it was interesting to see a card that is so outrageously good in the deck be that hard to see kind of like from a new card perspective as people are evaluating it. I think like Solitude, like people were like, okay, like at minimum, this is playable as a one of.
Yeah.
I don't think when Modern Horizons 2 was released, like zero amount of Death and Taxes players were pre-ordering four of those cards. Like 0%. At least that would be my bet. But
it was like when Conspiracy 2 came out. It was like, you know, one day Recruiter of the Guard was spoiled. And, you know, I was always on the fence about buying like Imperial Recruiters. And it was like, this is just better. And I was like, just pre-ordered four from like Star Cities, the only place I could find them. And then like a day later, Sanctum Prelate was spoiled. And I was like, I need four of those. And just like pre-ordered those also from Star City.
It was a wild set for D&T. I remember seeing Sanctum Prelate and I was like, I'm pretty sure if you told me to design a card for Death and Taxes, like this is a card that Death and Taxes would need to like really go up to the next level. I would have built something worse than Sanctum Prelate. Sanctum Prelate just like crushed it.
Right. You'd be like, that's too much. I'm not going to ask for that.
Yeah. this is too far. We can't just have like non-creature Chalice of the Void on any number. That's not fair. But I clocked Solitude a little bit as someone who had played Yorion in the past, but still wasn't like super interested in playing Yorion again. I dropped off the Yorion train after the ban because I valued the consistency and like the I was more concerned about the aggressive Delver decks when you're kind of like playing a slow game and you have like Path to Exiles when Delver's moving to blue red and you give them basics and stuff. But I kind of clocked it. I was like, oh, this is definitely like playable as a one of with like Recruiter of the Guard. I like that interaction a lot. So maybe it's relevant there. And I played with it a little bit and I bumped up the numbers. I played like another one, like the sideboard, because I thought it was really good. The Necrotal lifelink mode is just really good against the control decks because I love creatures. But then one day I got bored of 60 card D&T because my list, I was like playing a list that was doing fine. But I was like, let me try Yorion again and just see how it feels. I just put four Solitudes in and I was like, oh, wait. I broke it.
It's never been so broken, except when you're playing Force of Virtue, the Hawks.
Yes. Oh, God. That deck was something else.
Squadron Hawk Solitude is a good combo.
Yeah.
80 card Yorion Squawks and Texts.
I couldn't fit Squadron Hawk into the list, unfortunately. Maybe one day.
What do you mean you got 80 cards? You got lots of room for Squadron Hawks.
I mean, you already have a free white card to pitch. Just cost 3 mana now.
We have even more free white cards to pitch to our other Solitudes now.
A lot of white pitch cards.
So this is kind of a reoccurring theme on the podcast, but Jeff actually did this whole like section on his box of bad white cards that he has, like his, what I affectionately call his actual D&T deck, but it's all of like the maybe board of his D&T.
I think I have mine like 15 feet away from me in a closet right now.
You need it at like arm's reach at all time, right?
Yeah.
Before the weekly, you're like, ooh, it's time to shine.
Like so you did mention at the top of the cast or before the cast that today, like August 25th, recording today, you got to Mangara someone in Caracas. Like, I'm curious, what's like the worst or some of the worst cards that you've ever registered in D&T? not as like a total meme, but like big brain, this is going in the deck.
Number one off the top of my head is Crusading Knight.
I need to Google this one actually.
Yeah, everyone feel free to search that
one. Hold on. So to me, that sounds like some kind of like protection and first striking something, but I could be totally wrong. Oh, no.
It's pro black.
Is it like Split Second? Which one am I thinking?
No.
Beyond, it's from Invasion.
That classic.
This is like your heyday, right, McBain?
Oh, yeah. No. I should totally have this. I was thinking of the Acolytes for a moment there.
This is bad, JR.
It's not good.
Okay, I'm at a loss. What do you got?
So it's a 4-mana 2/2. Oh, it's 2 and 2 white, 4-mana. You got anything?
Okay. No.
Protection from black. It's a 2/2. Crusading Knight gets +1/+1 for each swamp your opponents control.
So it's like a better angry mob?
Yeah, I was going to say it's a slight upgrade on angry mob.
I need a better angry mob.
No, it was the I'm losing to Grixis too much and I want something to recruit her for.
Do you remember there was like a brief moment when people were trying to convince people to play what the fuck is it called? It's triple white and it's like a creature that comes into play and exiles a black
pearl. Devout Lightcaster.
Yes.
Never put that card in your deck. It's impossible to cast. D&T's mana base is so bad. never casting triple white cards. But people, yeah, when I think Death Shadow like won an SCG, like a team SCG, right? And then people were all over that deck and were just like, oh, play Devout Lightcaster. And I'm just like, no, you're never gonna put it into play. But yeah, Crusading Knight was technology that I and I alone played for one tournament because I was tired of losing to Grixis players and it didn't work. But the idea behind it was that Grixis was on like one lightning bolt and just all black cards, like black removal spells. So they just like couldn't kill it. And if you have two swamps to play, it's unboltable already. And then the one time I ever put it into play in my whole life, it got bolt snap bolted.
Oh, classic degenerate blue players.
During Grixis' heyday, I played an Absolute Grace in my sideboard of Infect.
I do own an Absolute Grace and an Absolute Law.
Yeah, when I started playing D&D, Absolute Law was like at least in the kind of realm of suggested sideboard things.
I've resolved many Absolute Laws against McBain from when he used to play lands.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Just
go to town.
Oh, Christ. Other bad cards, like this is like the best card. This is like our peak of the cast.
I don't think it's gonna get worse than Crusading Knight. I got some some stinkers in there though.
You ever play a Riftmark Knight?
No, is that the suspend one?
Yes, it's so good.
It makes like a token, another token that's like pro like black, and then one of them is pro white. It makes a black token that is pro white, and it's a white card that is pro black.
Wow.
We're in the presence,
and it has Master's flanking.
Plan. Flanking, yes. The classic line of text that I've couldn't remember. I don't own one of those.
Oh, guys, I'm muted for. There's a train going by, and I was trying to shut it down. Riftmark Knight was a technology when Miracles was pretty popular, and also True Name was a thing. Because you'd have a creature with pro white that was very difficult, an uncounterable creature with pro white that was very difficult for Miracles to deal with. And then also you'd attack with your knight, and they'd be like, yeah, block with True Name. And you'd be like, flanking?
Flanking, gotcha. No one knows what that line of text means. Gotcha, idiot. Stillmoon Cavalier is another one in that sort of vein.
Ooh. Is that like the Orzhov hybrid one from Lorwyn or something?
It's got like black, pro white. You can pay like a white or black and give it like +1/+0, or you can pay like 2 white to give it like flying or something like that.
Have you ever done banding?
I don't think I own any cards with banding in the D&T box.
It's just like a total, like, I've been playing some Ice Age Alliances, Alice format, and there's banning in that. But the idea that you get to choose damage on your blocks, like, and, like, redirect everything to something and then crack back is alluring, but at the same time, now you've got like Cauldron Complete, so you don't even have to think about combat. You just fucking smash him with that.
I don't think there's any like playable cards with banding either.
At some point, like, my group chat was trying to think of the worst 80th card I could put in the deck to try to 5-0 with to just meme on people. And I think one of them was a card with banding. I think it's like a I think it might just be a 1/1 for 1 with banding, or maybe it's
Benelishiro?
Benelishiro?
Maybe it's Benelishiro.
There's a couple pseudo Benelishiro cards as well, yeah. But that would be the ideal one. And
I like the idea though. This reminds me. So we did locally, we used to have like proxies allowed at the weekly we go to. And there was a night we all decided to do like the standstill challenge, which is like everybody brings a deck containing like 4 copies of standstill and just see who like does the best. And McBain, I don't know if he actually did it, but his plan was just to play Eldrazi and just put 4 standstills in it that you can't cast. So think about that when you're trying to think of the worst 80th card you could put in the deck.
It's almost like putting Leyline of the Void in your sideboard that you can never possibly cast.
What if you put like Play of the Game in as like the 80th card? Flex on them. Put Abandoned Hope in there.
Fantastic. So clearly, I think just like the one other, as we're like descending into the madness, I think the real play is playing more than 80 cards.
Yeah, I think the tech is play 81.
The 81 is probably correct because it further dilutes your one-ups that makes them like even less likely to draw them in the wrong matchup.
Well, let me put my goblin hat on for a second. You can have so many, you know, things, and you can tutor them all. Therefore, 81 is a perfect science.
Yeah, I don't have the argument that Lackey always makes, Eli, is ringleader math, which is... I'm not a math guy. I guess I am a math guy. I'm an engineer, but I don't want to try to think about fucking ringleader statistics.
Are you like a civil engineer then?
I'm an electrical engineer. I actually am a math guy.
Okay.
But he always talks about like when you're sideboarding out like X number of cards, you want to keep your ringleader numbers high enough. You have to play 61 for whatever reason. So I don't have any way to con myself into doing that. So I just got to talk about like, oh, you just want access to your fifth recruiter bullet, you know, play your Palace Jailer or whatever. I hate Palace Jailer. Don't play Palace Jailer.
Yeah, I was kind of waiting for you to say that was the worst card.
My last league, I registered Palace Jailer, but I'm just trying it out again because Sam Rolfe, who won the showcase, had 2 Palace Jailers, which was kind of insane. But I was like, I'll give it a shot again, and then I'm just going to cut it after a league because I hate it. And then lo and behold, I had Spirit of the Labyrinth and Palace Jailer in play in the same game, and I didn't get to draw my extra card. And I was like, this card fucking sucks.
You know why it's good to play 2 Palace Jailer is because after you lose the Monarchy, you can play the second one to get it back.
Genius.
And then they're like that much more in the hole to never get it back from you.
Yeah.
Like,
you do next level people in the mirror, because it used to be the best Palace Jailer was the second one in the mirror, because once you Palace Jailer their Palace Jailer, then it's just like the game's over. But then if you have a second Palace Jailer, then you just totally blow them out because they never expect it.
So clearly 3 Palace Jailers is the appropriate number. This is how whoever arrived at like 3 Palace Jailers of like, well, I'm just gonna, you know, keep going up on this.
This is really how DNT drops down from tier 1 is the Palace Jailer Armatures.
I mean, I actually, yes. I really think people need to be cutting that card. I think Ragavan is like the Palace Jailer of blue decks, where it's just you don't actually want it in anything except for mirrors, but everyone keeps playing it. So if you're not playing it, you're just severely disadvantaged in those mirrors. So I think a lot of the analogies that we're talking about with Ragavan actually do apply to Jailer, except for DNT's a small enough percentage of the meta versus all blue decks that right. You can just get away with not playing Palace Jailer and just like not play the mirror or whatever, or just like play against people on the 60 card mirror when you're on Yorion, and then you just get to crush them into the dust anyway.
Oh, this feels good. I have to say, like, looking at like the Yorion list and playing them again really kind of cured some of my DNT burnout, where I was like, you know, playing 60 and I was like not super excited about a lot of like the play patterns and stuff, just the way games are going. They felt like I just didn't have a lot of like agency. And then going to like 80 card and just like constantly finding everything I need and like, oh yeah, I've got the third solitude and like, you know, just dealing with everything. It feels so good. And it gets my little gears just spinning.
Yeah. Not only is it like the best I think D&D's ever been since I've been playing for like 8 years.
I think like genuinely D&T's like at its highest point, but also it's just like the most fun. Yorion's just a really fun card to play. You get to flicker out your like four creatures and you get to like, all right, I'll stack my Skyclave and then my flicker is targeting the Skyclave, then also get a recruiter and go get a solitude. And
it's kind of like resolving like show and tell into omniscience or something. You're like, I'm going to do all the things. It's like, that's your Yorion.
We also get to play with like, what, three different flicker effects, three different types of flicker effects between Flicker Wisp, Charming Prince, and Yorion. They all have different conditions. Yeah. And like, because Prince is, you just have to own it.
Yes.
But Yorion needs you to own and control.
Yes, unfortunately.
That's got me when I started playing with it. I was like, sucker, I'm just going to flicker this and get it right back. It was like, oh, never mind.
R&D missed on that one.
Yeah.
Here they are putting actual good text on things.
That's one of the more tame mistakes they've made lately, to be fair.
So Jason Murray, like we've touched on him a few times here. Like, was he really the like original brainchild who shared the Yorion list with you? And then you just kind of said, that's cool. And ran with it, or do you guys work back and forth on the deck?
Yeah, so Jason and I are good friends. He's one of the people in the group chat I talked about earlier. He copied it from, well, not copied it, but during the actual companion era, I forget who. I feel dumb for not being able to remember who it was, but someone played just an actual, like, normal 80-card Yorion Death Tags of deck back before the companion nerf. And then the companions got nerfed and everything just like faded away for a couple months. But he ran it through a league. Meanwhile, I got a DM from one of the Zoomer cabal on Twitter. Henry, I forget his last name, but
Milstein, right?
Is it? I forget his name. So. He's Peanut Brittle on Modo. I can remember people's Modo names more than their actual names, but he DM'd me at some point. He's like, what do you think about Yorion? Blah, 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 blah. Talks about like why it's good. And I was like, I don't think it's very good. Blah, blah, blah. Aether Vial on turn one. All the talking points that like people just echoed to me. And then like 3 days later, Jason comes to me and was like, oh, well, I 5-0'd two leagues straight with Yorion D&T. I think it might be really good. And then I played it in a league and I was like, wow, this is super busted. And then I played it in a challenge and I won it. And I was just like, all right, well, You did in fact break it. Congratulations. then I looked like an idiot. I went back to Henry and I was like, yeah, egg on my face about this one.
Well, I don't know if it's like egg on the face. Like, I think it's just like, that's the great part about one being a deck expert, playing Legacy and having that community to kind of circulate ideas on. It's a lot different than the Delver cabal, who's just like, again, the butterfly meme where it's just like one change to the 75 and it's like, is this a brew?
Yeah, exactly. I brewed a deck in Delver.
So I think that's Quinn. Is there any questions that you had? I'm all out of I have one other question, but we're going to save that for a few minutes.
I only have those level zero ones that I asked already.
I was just going to say, this really also goes to the merit of believing a card is good and then putting in your deck and putting up results with it. I'm not going to say anything else about that, but.
Jeff, don't start a beef.
But it, in a similar vein, it does go to show, like, don't necessarily like just write off cards.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's like, oh, I think this card's like probably not good. Like, it's worth jumping through the hoops a lot of the time. Like, I didn't jump through the hoops with the Yorion, and my friend did, and he was like, wait, this is actually busted. But then later I was like, Cauldron, this card probably sucks, but I think it's worthwhile enough to like give it a shot at least. And then you play it and it's like, wow, this card's amazing. Obviously you don't do that with every card. Sometimes cards are very obviously bad. You don't have to test them, but there are a lot of cards that are like more borderline than you'd expect. And you know, you'll find some hidden gems for sure.
So like, not a lot of people pick up Oko right away.
Quinn?
I was going to say, not a lot of people picked up Oko right away, even, you know?
Yeah. People were, I think a part of it was like not knowing what food tokens were at the start, but turns out that didn't matter at all. But people did underrate Oko initially, and then it was like one of the most broken cards ever.
Yeah, you only had to play for like 2 seconds to realize what was happening. But
yeah, exactly. Except if you're R&D, apparently.
Yeah.
I'm feeling my heart right now. I'm getting all hot. I'm just thinking.
Yeah, just getting mad thinking about it. It's one of the reasons I can never play Vintage. He's still there lurking.
Yeah.
Going one for one with people and being like, I ran them out of cards and I have a creature. I'm going to win. And they're like, Oko. And you're like, oh, God.
Instantly dead.
It is interesting, that idea of groupthink in the Legacy community, particularly like on some of the main message boards or Twitter. I think there's a lot of Magic names that exist on Twitter and they get their opinions from Twitter. I think it would be very easy to do a podcast if you just like watched Twitter and looked at the Legacy challenge results, and you could be like, oh, I've played for 5 or 6 years, I can formulate an opinion. But really, you're just kind of regurgitating that groupthink, and you're not, like you said, JR, doing like the legwork and actually like proving it to yourself to say, oh, is culture good or not? And is Oko good or not? Like it's easy to say, yeah, this is busted and not busted. And that's what everyone says. Therefore, everyone believes it. But until you actually put in the legwork and actually play the actual freaking game and not just talk about it and never play, I'm looking at Jeff when I say this. then it's you're kind of doing a disservice to the community and yourself. So either put in the work and try, or just don't have opinions like they're gospel.
Don't aggressively think that something's like unplayable and without like ever trying.
Yeah.
It's something I really had to fight people on when I started playing Yorion. Everyone was just like, no, this card's, why would you ever play this? Blah, blah, Aether Vial, whatever. And then like people like didn't even do anything with it. I won a challenge and then me and Jason kept crushing with it. People kept ignoring it. Luckily, the second time around, people were a lot more accepting of the idea when I won a challenge. And then Marcus won the challenge the next week. And then Yorion D&T has been putting up like crazy results ever since. So people take some time sometimes for people to dig in.
Yeah, there's two thoughts that come to mind on that. Like, it is pretty impressive, some of the things that are, as you said properly earlier, niche, not niche. Some of the niche things, like even like goblins or something like that, where it can be well positioned and be doing well and putting up results, and people just say, you know what, I'm not going to do it. Like, I don't want to play it. I don't want to do that. And like in an alternate universe, like the whole metagame could actually shift, and like goblins could be like the metagame player it was in 2011 or something, or 2008. Like there's all sorts of swings that the Legacy metagame could do. People just actually refuse to change.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's just what it is. But it's an interesting idea that like how it feels like some like corporate thing of like trying to get your new initiative through the company's like executive and board or something. You're like, no, I swear this deck is playable. Like, look, I've got all this backing. And yeah, it's interesting that things change, and yourself and Jason and a couple of the other folks have been doing great work promoting the deck. So hats off. The other point, this kind of goes into the splitting the planes discussion, because we have to go there. Like we have to end the podcast on this.
High horse.
So you like, I think we can all agree that splitting the planes is absolutely incorrect, and you should never do it, even in a predict metagame.
Smart. I should have asked that
at the top of the podcast to make sure, because if you guys had said display your plans, I might have just left.
You were hovering over the disconnect button. I know. Now, if you said you on the Dark Depths podcast you played MPS Planes, but for the new Death and Taxes player that you're so good at recruiting into the meat grinder that is Legacy when you don't know how to play the deck properly, what's like the introductory planes that people should be playing before they kind of graduate to the finer wines of planes art?
I don't know the prices of some of like the more like classically accepted like good planes. I think the easiest one to point to is like the Thundercloud planes. This one's like very iconic.
That was recently reprinted, was it not? In something?
I think you might be right about that. I think it was reprinted.
Jeff knows so. This. He knows his planes are in
Modern Horizons 2, right?
Was it Modern Horizons 2?
I think.
I have no idea.
Nobody's played with this in paper. It's impossible.
Yeah, what is paper?
Whatever it is, it's got a bad border, so it's
not a replacement. New border. So buy the old border ones, though. That was one of my favorites. It's like a very easy classic, good looking one. Don't be me. Don't play the Hour of Devastation planes on Moto. Everyone makes fun of you for that.
I was thinking like as perhaps as like a gift for coming on the podcast, we could like donate you a new set of planes on Magic Online to play with. So that you don't have to play the Hour of Devastation ones.
Callum did that for me for Mountains when we were like breaking the Zerda deck back in the Companion era. I played like a red version at some point. He's like, you gotta play better Mountains, my guy. He just sent me like 10 good Mountains. And those are the only good lands that I own on Moto. But yeah, don't play those.
I do enjoy the irony of like the introductory D&T, the guy who's kind of like promoting and getting everyone in to also be like, oh, well, I'm only going to play the Hour of Devastation ones on Moto because I don't think highly of myself.
It's a brand at this point. People get mad about it, but it's just like, I got to stick to my guns. I can't bow down now after I've gone so long.
Not even for some
problem with going to Yorion was buying more MPS planes.
Yeah, a lot of people got mad about that because some planes are really expensive. Some people have like the like APAC or like Euro plans. Those things are like 25, 50 bucks or more. It's just like, I'm sorry that I put an extra 8 planes in this deck.
Oh, McBain Peacekeeper locked me and he had like beta planes behind him and like tucked underneath the Peacekeeper was some like new border one.
Hey, well, to be fair, so I was in the same boat. I didn't have like 33 or 34 or whatever the number is of one planes. But I had a lot of revised ones. So I had like 32 revised ones or something, and I was two off. I was like, oh, whatever. Like, I got to find something. So I had, 34 revised or whatever, revised / beta ones / unlimited. But I had two that I needed to fill, and I had those Bob Ross planes. I was like, well, these are pretty wholesome. Like, who can hate Bob Ross other than Quinn, apparently? But so I put the Bob Ross ones in there. But I do also have that APEC one with like the windmill and the flowers and stuff. That one's really beautiful. Definitely not an introductory planes to kind of get into.
Yeah. My introductory planes was the Dragon's Maze promo.
Mm.
Those are the planes I used before I switched to the MPS ones.
Invasions and Masks always had really nice planes in my mind. And then you got the Ice Age ones as well with the, well, they've got like really neat colors in the, really rich colors in the Ice Age ones, but they also have that whole like one giant piece of art effect that you can do, which is cool.
It's Invasion is the like the field of like grain. It's like a lot of like browns, yellows, and orange colors. That one's really good. It's one of my friend's favorites.
Hmm. And I would assume that you're an old border player when it comes to your D&T deck, or are you like new border Japanese foil?
I'm a promo in Taxes player, actually.
First misstep.
D&D can have a lot of promos. I think it's really cool.
It's true. It can. It probably has like the highest density of possible promos, right?
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, I think like Painter could be like the whole like, what are they called? Expeditions?
The inventions.
Yeah. Inventions, where like everything is like Pringle foil. I think Painter can kind of have the highest density there.
But. Yeah, Painter's pretty high up on the list. But yeah, D&T's got like almost everything at this point. If you count the new, like the old border stuff, like old border wisps and stuff, I think the only non-promo cards in my list right now are like Recruiter of the Guard and Charming Prince. Those would be the only ones.
Which Thalia do you play?
I just switched to the Secret Layers, actually. I used to play the
Thalia?
Selfie Thalia, Waifu Thalia. But now I play the Secret Layer mix.
Oh, you play the mix? You don't like stick with one?
Nah. I'm playing Death Attacks. They know I have four Thalias in my deck. I don't have to psych them out.
No, I know, but just from like an art preference. But yes. Okay.
No, I thought about getting one all of one or something, but I kind of like the uniqueness of having like the four different Thalia arts all from the same Secret Layer. They do the same thing for the Mother of Runes when those come out. Those arts are really sick too.
Yeah, some of those are pretty incredible. There is also the Fish Duggery, or our friend Elliot, who's also a local, and that would be playing like a different totally set for this. So you'd have like original foil Urza's Legacy Mom, and then like promo mom, and then
as if you just play, ever touch four Mother Runes.
Okay, well, maybe that was a bad example, but like that would be the idea, is like you play as many different arts,
as many mismatching as well. Yeah, I built goblins and I did that. I thought it was very on theme for a goblins deck to just be a complete mishmash of garbage.
That is appropriate.
And it's got a lot of different arts and stuff. It's a good one for doing that.
I do like that. Like, again, just this is just like, well, any format could do this, but Legacy is one where you really do invest a lot, like monetarily and in terms of your time into your particular deck, and like having your kind of way that you like to present and play the deck is, I think, a big part of one, just continuing to be a committed person in the community, but also just to have like your brand when you show up and they go, oh, you're on the MPS planes. Okay, I respect that. You're like, oh no, I actually only play my summer planes and I have 34 of them, which is half of the summer planes in the world right here. Like, there's like that. That's like pretty sweet. Like those people who like do, you know, this is my thing. But do we want to round it out here, Jeff?
Anything else? Moving on to the last segment. Which I feel weird now that I've been wrangled into starting this. I don't know if I ever have. I'm gonna do my best Quinn impression here. And we like to end the show on a positive note by shouting out someone or something in the community that is gas. Since I'm going first, I'm gonna say Quinn. Who is gas?
I'm gonna shout out I think we've shouted them all out before, but. At once, the Dead Format, Leaving a Legacy, and Eternal Turtles, which were the three Legacy podcasts I listened to before I was like, you know, we could do this. That sounds like an insult to them. They're much better than us. But they've also kind of been like sporadically putting out content. And I know that especially over like the last year and a half, I think we've felt that at times too, to be like, what are we going to talk about? I don't even feel like playing Magic this week. So just shout out to those folks. For hanging in there, even if things are coming a little more slowly. Hopefully things stop going down the shitter and improve again, and we can all get back to having lots of stuff to talk about. But regardless, every time I see my podcast app and one of those three pops up, I get excited.
I wouldn't know anything about that. He's too busy not listening to Legacy podcasts. And I guess
I think that's a fine way to spend your time, to be fair.
Making the smartest choice out of all of us.
I'm just surprised that as an owner of dogs, you're not like listening to Legacy podcasts when you're walking dogs.
Oh, like, I was gonna say, is there like a dog podcast you listen to?
I do listen to some podcasts. I don't know what it is about Magic, but I just can't like listen to like a bunch of like talk. Absolutely no offense to any actual Legacy podcast. You guys all work very hard.
We're right here. We're right here.
But just like, I can't listen to like people like just have like a talk show about the things that I think a lot of it is just like how involved I already am in like what's going on and how much I'm already like have my finger on the pulse of the meta and stuff. And just like, I don't need these like constant updates and stuff. But I mean, to people that are, there are, I'm probably in the top, you know, whatever percent of people that are actually fixated on the Legacy format. So people that are like more casually committed, I'm sure this type of format is way more helpful.
It goes back to that groupthink thing. And I think it can be helpful and unhelpful. Like if people are being particularly negative about something and like the blue players are all crying about Ragavan and how they're just trying to murder each other with the card, it can be particularly troublesome for the format where everyone's like, oh, I guess like Legacy is not that great anymore. And you're like, no, just don't listen to those like 12 idiots who are all yelling really loudly. Turn like, stop the listening to the mainstream
media.
Yeah. Listening to too much Fox News. Mom, get off of there. Yeah. So Jeff, what about you?
I wanted to shout out a podcast that's much more successful than ours and is a Magic podcast that I've been listening to lately. So like, I kind of get overloaded if I start listening to a lot of Legacy podcasts. Like I like basically all of them, and I'll go through spurts where I start listening to them a bunch, and then I just like, this is too much. I can't take all this analytical stuff, and I just don't listen to them often. But in the last couple of weeks, I finally took Elliot's advice and started listening to the Resleevables, which is like Cedric Phillips and Patrick Sullivan.
I've heard
just great. Talking about like old, yeah, like old like formats and like limited sets. And like, man, what a trip. Like listening to them just like talk about Prophecy and like Odyssey, all the sets I played like when I was younger. And, you know, as I just go through, like every single one of these cards is terrible. I'm like, I just didn't even think about it that way. You know, as a kid, you open a pack of Odyssey and you're like, oh, hell yeah, this thing blows up somebody's lands. This is the best. So it's been a very enjoyable way to, as McBain said, walk the dog and listen to all these stories. And it's really got me really missing like competitive play also, like proper, you know, a proper GP or something big and just hearing these tournament stories and stuff. So right now it feels good. In short order, I think it's going to be damaging to my mental health as we're locked out of the United States and can't go to Puget Sound Battleground. McBain?
I was going to hand it over to JR, actually, and then I can round out with some. So is there any particular That's Gas that you'd like to shout out? It could be a card, a deck.
Unrelated person.
A person. A Discord that you're not the moderator of.
I don't have a lot of solid shout-outs. I'll shout out just my D&T, not so much a D&T anymore group chat. Shout-outs to them because they're just always super helpful when I need to like bounce ideas off of people. It helps being able to talk to people that kind of understand your wavelength a lot of the time and not just going onto a public forum. And I had a Twitter post about this earlier where like Legacy or in general Magic Facebook groups are just the real bottom of the barrel.
Hey, Thawing Glaciers is an amazing card and you stop it right now, sir.
someone posted Thawing Glaciers in the D&T Facebook group and it's just some people just, I don't understand how you can like, I understand you can have ideas. Some people just like really like deck building. And especially if you don't play online, it's really hard to play at all right now. So just like you have to theory craft some things, but like having an idea that's so out there, like Thawing Glaciers and just being like, I'm going to go post this and ask a bunch of strangers what they think. It's just like, that is a level of confidence that I will never have in my life.
This is your tribe though. How dare you say this about your D&T tribe? Like you're like, but, it, I almost envision it as like an NBA team or something like that, but it's in like some backwater city. You're not in New York and like that. And it's just like, well, I've got this professional team and we play really well. And there's like 10 people. And then we have to fill the stadium with a bunch of idiots. And we have really cheap tickets. So like anyone and their dog will show up. and I got to fill the seats. Like, and that's just what I do. And there's the thawing glaciers section, and there's the, I don't know what other bad card.
Smothering tithe.
Yeah, there's the smothering tithe side.
Anything with the word tithe in it. If it tithes or taxes, people want to talk to
it. I remember joining the D&T Discord years ago, and it felt like you just like walk in, I open the door, and these people are arguing about including like awful cards, and I was like, I'm not looking in this Discord anymore.
I'm not the biggest fan of some of the conversations that go on in the Discord sometimes, but I was really proud of the same day that Thawing Glaciers got posted. There was like a very productive discussion about like why there were like three Sanctum Prelates in Sam's list in the showcase and stuff. And they were talking about like the upsides of like going to two or maybe even going to zero, stuff like that. I was like, I've at least done something here because they stopped posting Tithe Taker.
So just to round things out, and maybe this kind of is the full circle piece, but this is one of my most favorite games as a kid. And that's Final Fantasy VII. And it does tie back, as I understand it, to your XJ Cloud name. Final Fantasy VII is an incredible game. I think that was the first time like I ever really, really got into a video game, particularly like a game like Final Fantasy VII. And like the theme of it with like the whole, you know, protect the earth and all that, and then randomly getting Ares killed, spoiler alert. it was just a fantastic game.
Tag your podcast with Final Fantasy VII spoilers now.
But yeah, just I want to shout out Final Fantasy VII as gas. I have not played the new remade version.
So good. I haven't played, they had some like DLC or something that I did not play, but I played the remake. The remake was amazing.
Oh yeah. Okay. All right. I know you're heavily biased, obviously, but I was close. I just don't have like immediately the system. I'd have to do a bunch of backflips to do it, but
yeah,
the original Final Fantasy VII, like it's obviously like of a certain time when you're playing that game where like the graphics seem incredible, even though you look back at it now and everything's just like a bunch of squares and circles.
Four polygons per character.
Yeah. But such an incredible game. So incredible. If you have to not have Cloud as your name, but some character from Final Fantasy VII, who would be like your runner up? Don't mail this in.
My brain immediately went to Zach, but that also feels like a cop out because Zach is basically Cloud. So
that was the mail-in choice. So what's the actual choice?
I played God, what was the PSP game where you play Zach?
That was good. Shit, what was that called?
What was that? Crisis Core. Final Fantasy VII Crisis Core.
Yes.
Like I liked Zack as a character, probably just because I liked Cloud, though, to be honest. But in terms of other characters from Final Fantasy VII, I would name myself after Vincent's probably also my favorite. Vincent, obviously, extremely edgy, cool vampire guy with a gun that like 8-year-old me or whatever absolutely loved.
That was like the coolest shit ever at the time, right?
Yeah, he's a vampire with a gun. Like, what else do you want?
Obviously, spoilers, a cat riding a robot. So that would be like, screw Lord of the Rings crossover. I want my Final Fantasy VII set released.
Oh, dang. They should definitely do a Final Fantasy crossover. They need to put Cloud on a white card so I can play it in D&T and then fully live my dream.
Or even just like the redone art ones where it's still like Thalia, it's just now I don't know, Ares or something.
I want a Stoneforge for a Buster Sword.
Yeah, exactly. Umezawa's Jitte as like Buster Sword. some dumb shit.
I think that's the perfect spot to land it on. Buster Sword.
Anything else you guys want to talk about?
Yeah.
Well, Final Fantasy VII you want to talk about more.
Anything else you guys want to talk about before we wrap up the podcast?
No.
All right. Well, JR, thanks for joining us. I know for me, It's been a pleasure to talk to a master D&T player for the first time, someone who can really understands the deck, has some success with it.
I hear that's in short supply on this podcast.
I feel like I finally am starting to get it based on, you know, what you've been able to provide for us. And I'm sure our listeners feel the same way. And on that note, thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you in Two Thresholds.